If the autocrats at Smolny also infringe on the Constituent Assembly, the Socialist Revolutionary Party will remember its old, tried and true tactics. Perhaps it did remember, but it didn't make up its mind to act. Yet apparently it could be tried for it anyway. In this area of our investigation, Krylenko complained because of conspiracy, there will be little testimony from witnesses. And he continued, this has made my task extremely difficult. In this area, that is terrorism, it is necessary at certain moments to wander about in the shadows. What made Krylenko's task difficult was the fact that the use of terrorism against the Soviet government was discussed at the meeting of the SR Central Committee in 1918 and rejected. And now, years later, it was necessary to prove that the SRs had been engaged in self-deception. The SRs had said at the time that they would not resort to terrorism until and unless the Bolsheviks began to execute socialists. Or in 1920, they had said that if the Bolsheviks were to threaten the lives of SR hostages, then the party would take up arms. It was evidently all right to shoot the other hostages. So the question then was, why did they qualify their renunciation of terrorism? Why wasn't it absolute? And how had they even dared to think about taking up arms? Why were there no statements equivalent to absolute renunciation? But, Comrade Krylenko, maybe terrorism was their second nature. The SR Party carried out no terrorist acts whatsoever, and this was clear even from Krylenko's summing up of the charges. But the prosecution kept stretching such facts as these. One of the defendants had in mind a plan for blowing up the locomotive of a train, carrying the Council of People's Commissars to Moscow. That meant the Central Committee of the SRs was guilty of terrorism. And the terrorist Ivanova had spent one night near the railroad station with one charge of explosives, which meant there had been an attempt to blow up Trotsky's train, and therefore the SR Central Committee was guilty of terrorism. And further, Donskoy, a member of the Central Committee, warned Fania Kaplan that she would be expelled from the party if she fired at Lenin. But that wasn't enough. Why hadn't she been categorically forbidden to? Or perhaps, why hadn't she been denounced to the Cheka? It was feathers of this sort that Krylenko kept plucking from the dead rooster, that the SRs had not taken measures to stop individual terrorist acts by their unemployed and languishing gunmen. That was the whole of their terrorism. Yes, and those gunmen of theirs didn't do anything either. In 1922, two of them, Konopleva and Semyonov, with suspicious eagerness, enriched the GPU and the tribunal with their voluntary evidence. But their evidence couldn't be pinned on the SR Central Committee, and suddenly and inexplicably, these inveterate terrorists were released scot-free. All the evidence was such that it had to be bolstered up with props. Krylenko explained things this way in regard to one of the witnesses. If this person had really wanted to make things up, it is unlikely he would have done so in such a way as to hit the target merely by accident. Strongly put indeed, this could be said about any piece of fabricated testimony whatever. Or else, about Donskoy. Could one really suspect him of possessing the special insight to testify to what the prosecution wanted? It was just the other way around with Konopleva. The reliability of her testimony was evidenced by the fact that she had not testified to everything the prosecution needed, but enough for the defendants to be shot. If we ask whether Konopleva concocted all this, then it is clear. If one is going to concoct, one must have really concocted. He should know. And if one is going to expose someone, one should really expose him. But she, you see, did not carry it through to the end. Then things are put still another way. After all, it is unlikely that Yefimov needed to put Konopleva in danger of execution without cause. Once more correct, once more strongly put. Or even more strongly. Could this encounter have taken place? Such a possibility is not excluded. Not excluded? That means it did take place. Off to the races. Then, too, the subversive group. They talked about this for a long time, and then suddenly, dissolved for lack of activity. So what was all the fuss about? There had been several expropriations of money from Soviet institutions. The SRs had nothing with which to work, to rent apartments, to move from city to city. But previously these had been the lovely, noble exes, as all the revolutionists called them. And now, in a Soviet court, they were robbery and concealment of stolen goods. Through the material adduced by the prosecution in this trial, the dull, unblinking yellow street lamps of the law throw light on the whole uncertain, wavering, deluded history of this pathetically garrulous, essentially lost, helpless, and even inactive party, which never was worthily led. And its every decision or lack of decision, its every casting about, upsurge or retreat, was transformed into and regarded as total guilt. Guilt and more guilt. And if in September 1921, 10 months before the trial, the SR Central Committee, already sitting in the Butyrki, had written to the newly elected Central Committee that it did not agree to the overthrow of the Bolshevik dictatorship by any available means, but only through rallying the working masses and the dissemination of propaganda, all of which meant that even as they languished in prison, they did not agree to being liberated through either terrorism or conspiracy, then that, too, was converted into their primary guilt. Aha! So that means that you did agree to its overthrow. And what if they were, nevertheless, not guilty of overthrowing the government, and not guilty of terrorism, and if there had been hardly any expropriations at all, and if they had long since been forgiven for all the rest? Our favorite prosecutor pulled out his canonical weapon of last resort. Ultimately, failure to denounce is a category of crime applying to all the defendants without exception, and it must be considered as having been proved. The Socialist Revolutionary Party was guilty of not having squealed on itself. Now, there's something that couldn't miss. This represented a discovery that juridical thought had made in the new code. It was a paved highway, along which they would keep driving and driving grateful descendants into Siberia. And Krylenko burst out in a temper. Hardened eternal enemies! That's who the defendants are. In that case, it's quite clear, even without any trial, what has to be done with them. The code was still so new that Krylenko could not even remember the main counter-revolutionary articles by their numbers, but how he slashed about with those numbers, how profoundly he cited and interpreted them, just as if the blade of the guillotine had for decades hinged and dropped only on those articles. And especially new and important was the fact that we did not draw the distinction between methods and means the old Tsarist code had drawn. Such distinctions had no influence either on the classification of the charges or on the penalties imposed. For us, intent and action were identical. A resolution had been passed, we would try them for that. And whether it was carried out or not had no essential significance. Whether a man whispered to his wife in bed that it would be a good thing to overthrow the Soviet government, or whether he engaged in propaganda during elections or threw a bomb, it was all one and the same. And the punishment was identical. And just as a four-sighted painter proceeds from his first few brusquely drawn angular strokes to create the whole desired portrait, so for us, the entire panorama of 1937, 1945, and 1949 becomes ever clearer and more visible in the sketches of 1922. But no, one thing is missing. What's missing is the conduct of the defendants. They have not yet become trained sheep. They are still people. We have been told little, very little, but from that little we can understand a great deal. Sometimes, through carelessness, Krylenko cites what they said right at the trial. For example, the defendant Berg accused the Bolsheviks of responsibility for the deaths of January the 5th, shooting down those who were demonstrating on behalf of the Constituent Assembly. And what Liberov said was even more direct. I admit I was guilty of failing to work hard enough at overthrowing the Bolshevik government in 1918. Yevgenia Ratner adhered to the same line, and Berg also declared, I consider myself guilty before the workers' Russia for having been unable to fight with all my strength against the so-called workers' and peasants' government, but I hope that my time has not yet gone. It has gone, darling, all gone. Of course, there is in all this an element of the ancient passion for the resounding phrase, but there is firmness, too. The prosecutor argued the accused are dangerous to Soviet Russia because they consider everything they did to have been a good thing. Perhaps certain of the defendants find their own consolation in the hope that some future chronicler will praise them or their conduct at the trial. And a decree of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, issued after the trial, declared, "At the trial itself they reserve to themselves the right to continue their former activity." The defendant Gendelman Grabowski, a lawyer himself, was conspicuous during the trial for his arguments with Krylenko on tampering with the testimony of witnesses and on special methods of treating witnesses before the trial. In other words, the obvious working over they had gotten from the GPU. It is all there. All the elements are there. There was only a little way to go before attaining the ideal. Apparently, the preliminary interrogation had been conducted under the supervision of the prosecutor, that same Krylenko. And during that process, individual instances of a lack of consistency in testimony had been ironed out. Yet some testimony was presented for the first time only at the trial itself. Well, so what? So there were some rough spots. So it wasn't perfect. But in the last analysis, we have to declare altogether clearly and coldly that we are not concerned with the question of how the court of history is going to view our present deed. And as far as the rough spots are concerned, we will take them under advisement and correct them. But as it was, Krylenko, squirming, had to bring up, probably for the first and last time in Soviet jurisprudence, the matter of the inquiry, the initial inquiry required before investigation. And here's how cleverly he handled this point. The proceeding which took place in the absence of the prosecutor and which you considered the investigation was actually the inquiry, and the proceeding in the presence of the prosecutor, which you regarded as the reinvestigation, when all the loose ends were gathered up and all the bolts tightened, was really the investigation. The disorganized materials provided by the organs for inquiry and unverified by the investigation have much less value as proof than the materials provided by the skillfully directed investigation. Clever, wasn't it? Just try grinding that up in your mortar. To be practical about it, Krylenko no doubt resented having to spend half a year getting ready for this trial, then another 2 months barking at the defendants, and then having to drag out his summation for 15 hours, when all these defendants had more than once been in the hands of the extraordinary organs at times when these organs had extraordinary powers, but thanks to some circumstances or other, they had succeeded in surviving. So now Krylenko had to slave away to try and get them executed legally. There was, of course, only one possible verdict, execution for every last one of them. But Krylenko qualifies this generously, because this case is being watched by the whole world. The prosecutor's demand does not constitute a directive to the court, which the latter would be obliged to accept immediately for consideration or decision. What a fine court, too, that requires such an explanation. And indeed, the tribunal did demonstrate its daring in the sentences it imposed. It did not hand down the death penalty for every last one of them, but for 14 only. Most of the rest got prison and camp sentences, while sentences in the form of productive labor were imposed on another 100. And just remember, reader, remember, all the other courts of the Republic watch what the Supreme Tribunal does. It provides them with guidelines. The sentences of the Verkhtrib are used as directives for their guidance. As to how many more would now be railroaded in the provinces, you can figure that out for yourself. And, probably, on appeal, the decision of the Presidium of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee was worth the whole trial. The death sentences were to remain in effect, but not to be carried out for the time being. The further fate of those condemned would depend, then, on the conduct of those SRs who had not yet been arrested, apparently including those abroad as well. In other words, If you move against us, we'll squash them. In the fields of Russia, they were reaping the second peacetime harvest. There was no shooting except in the courtyards of the Cheka, Perkurov in Yaroslavl, Metropolitan Vanyamin in Petrograd. And always, always, always. Beneath the azure sky, our first diplomats and journalists sailed abroad across the blue waters, and the Central Executive Committee of Workers' and Peasants' Deputies thrust into its pockets eternal hostages. The members of the ruling party read all 60 issues of Pravda devoted to the trial, for they all read the papers, and all of them said, "Yes, yes, yes." No one mumbled, "No." What, then, were they surprised at in 1937? What was there to complain about? Hadn't all the foundations of lawlessness been laid, first by the extrajudicial reprisals of the Cheka, and then by these early trials and this young code? Wasn't 1937 also expedient? Expedient for Stalin's purposes, and perhaps history's too, for that matter. Prophetically, Krylenko let it slip that they were judging not the past, but the future. Only the first swath cut by the scythe is difficult. On or about August the 20th, 1924, Boris Viktorovich Savinkov crossed the Soviet border. He was immediately arrested and taken to the Lubyanka. Many hypotheses were advanced about his return. Only a little while ago, a certain Ardamatsky, a person obviously connected with the archives and personnel of the Committee for State Security, published a story which, despite being adorned with pretentiously inflated literary gewgaws, is evidently close to the truth. The magazine Neva, number 11, 1967. Having induced certain of Savinkov's agents to betray him, and having deceived others, the GPU used them to set a foolproof trap, convincing Savinkov that inside Russia a large underground organization was languishing for lack of a worthy leader. It would have been impossible to devise a more effective trap. And it would have been impossible for Savinkov, after such a confused and sensational life, merely to spin it out quietly to the end in Nice. He couldn't bear not trying to pull off one more feat and not returning to Russia and his death. In all, the interrogation lasted for just one session, which consisted solely of voluntary testimony and an evaluation of his activity. The official indictment was ready by August the 23rd. The speed was totally unbelievable, but it had impact. Someone had estimated the situation quite accurately. To have forced false and pitiful testimony out of Savinkov by torture would only have wrecked the authenticity of the picture. In the official indictment, couched in already well-developed terminology that turned everything upside down, Savinkov was charged with just about everything imaginable. With being a consistent enemy of the poorest peasantry, with assisting the Russian bourgeoisie in carrying out its imperialist ambitions, in other words, he was in favor of continuing the war with Germany, with maintaining relations with representatives of the Allied command, this would have been when he was in charge of the Ministry of War, with becoming a member of soldiers' committees for purposes of provocation, that is, he was elected by the soldiers' committees, and, last but not least, something to make even the chickens cackle with laughter, with having had monarchist sympathies. But all that was old hat. There were some new items, too. The standard charges for all future trials. Money from the imperialists. Espionage for Poland. They left out Japan, believe it or not. Yes, and he had also wanted to poison the Red Army with potassium cyanide, but for some reason he did not poison even one Red Army soldier. On August the 26th, the trial began. The presiding judge was Ulrich, this being our earliest encounter with him, and there was no prosecutor at all, nor any defense lawyer. Savinkov was lackadaisical in defending himself, and he raised hardly an objection at all to the evidence. He conceived of this trial in a lyrical sense. It was his last encounter with Russia and his last opportunity to explain himself in public, and to repent. Not of these imputed sins, but of others. And that theme song fitted well here and greatly confused the defendant. After all, we are all Russians together. You and we add up to us. You love Russia beyond a doubt, and we respect your love. And do we not love Russia too? In fact, are we not at present the fortress and the glory of Russia? And you wanted to fight against us? Repent. But it was the sentence that was most wonderful. Imposition of the death penalty is not required in the interests of preserving revolutionary law and order, and on the grounds that motives of vengeance should not influence the sense of justice of the proletarian masses. The death penalty was commuted to 10 years imprisonment. Now that was a sensation, and it confused many minds, too. Did it mean a relaxation, a transformation? Ulrich even published in Pravda an apologetic explanation of why Savinkov had not been executed. You see how strong the Soviet government has become in only 7 years. Why should it be afraid of some Savinkov or other? On the 20th anniversary of the revolution, it is going to get weaker, and don't be too hard on us because we are going to execute thousands. And so, on the heels of the first riddle of his return, there would have been the second riddle of his being spared capital punishment, had it not been overshadowed in May 1925 by a third riddle. In a state of depression, Savinkov jumped from an unbarred window into the interior courtyard of the Lubyanka, and the Gai Pyushniki, his guardian angels, simply couldn't manage to stop him and hold on to his big, heavy body. However, just in case, so that there wouldn't be any scandal in the service, Savinkov left them a suicide letter, in which he explained logically and coherently why he was killing himself, and this letter was so authentically phrased, so clearly written in Savinkov's style and vocabulary, that even Lev Borisovich, the son of the deceased, was fully convinced of its genuineness and explained to everyone in Paris that no one except his father could have written it, and that he had ended his life because he realized his political bankruptcy. And we, silly prisoners of a later Lubyanka, confidently parroted to one another that the steel nets hanging in the Lubyanka stairwells had been installed after Savinkov had committed suicide there. Thus do we succumb to fancy legends to the extent of forgetting that the experience of jailers is, after all, international in character. Such nets existed in American prisons as long ago as the beginning of the century, and how could Soviet technology have been allowed to lag behind? In 1937, when he was dying in a camp in the Kolyma, the former Czechist Artur Prajubel told one of his fellow prisoners that he had been one of the four who threw Savinkov from a fifth-floor window into the Lubyanka courtyard, and there is no conflict between that statement and Adamatsky's recent account. There was a low sill. It was more like a door to the balcony than a window. They had picked the right room. Only, according to Adamatsky, the guards were careless. According to Prajubel, they rushed him altogether. Thus, the second riddle, the unusually lenient sentence, was unravelled by the crude third riddle. The story ascribed to Prajubel could not be checked, but I had heard it, and in 1967 I told it to M.P. Yakubovich. He, with his still youthful enthusiasm and shining eyes, exclaimed, "I believe it! Things fit! And I didn't believe Blyumkin! I thought he was just bragging!" What he had learned was this. At the end of the 20s, Blyumkin had told Yakubovich, after swearing him to secrecy, that he was the one who had written Savinkov's so-called suicide note on orders from the GPU. Apparently Blyumkin was allowed to see Savinkov in his cell constantly while he was in prison. He kept him amused in the evenings. Did Savinkov sense that death was creeping up on him? Sly, friendly death, which gives you no chance to guess the form your end will take? And this had helped Blyumkin acquire Savinkov's manner of speech and thought, had enabled him to enter into the framework of his last ideas. And they ask, why throw him out the window? Wouldn't it have been easier simply to poison him? Perhaps they showed someone the remains, or thought they might need to. And where, if not here, is the right place to report the fate of Blyumkin, who, for all his Czechist omnipotence, was fearlessly brought up short by Mandelstam? Ehrenberg began to tell Blyumkin's story, and suddenly became ashamed and dropped the subject. And there is a story to tell, too. After the 1918 rout of the left SRs, Blyumkin, the assassin of the German ambassador Mirbach, not only went unpunished, was not only spared the fate of all the other left SRs, but was protected by Dzerzhinsky, just as Dzerzhinsky had wanted to protect Kozyrev. superficially converted to Bolshevism, and was kept on, one gathers, for particularly important assassinations. At one point, close to the 30s, he was secretly sent to Paris to kill Bajenov, a member of the staff of Stalin's secretariat who had defected, and one night he succeeded in throwing him off a train. However, his gambler's blood, or perhaps his admiration of Trotsky, led Blyumkin to the Prince's Islands in Turkey, where Trotsky was living. He asked Trotsky whether there were any assignments he could carry out for him in the Soviet Union, and Trotsky gave him a package for Radek. Blyumkin delivered it, and his visit to Trotsky would have remained a secret had not the brilliant Radek already been a stool pigeon. Radek brought down Blyumkin, who was thereupon devoured by the maw of the monster his own hands had suckled with its first bloody milk. And all the major and most famous trials are still ahead of us. Chapter 10. The Law Matures. But where were those mobs insanely storming the barbed wire barricades on our western borders whom we were going to shoot under Article 71 of the Criminal Code for unauthorized return to the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic? Contrary to scientific prediction, there were no such crowds, and that article of the code dictated by Lenin to Kursky remained useless. The only Russian crazy enough to do it was Savinkov, and they had ducked applying that article even to him. On the other hand, the opposite penalty, exile abroad instead of execution, was tried out immediately on a large scale. In those days, when he was composing the Criminal Code, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, developing his brilliant idea, wrote in the heat of the moment on May the 19th, "Comrade Dzerzhinsky, on the question of exiling abroad writers and professors who aid the counter-revolution, this is a measure which must be prepared most carefully. Unless we prepare well, we can commit stupidities. We must arrange the business in such a way as to catch these military spies and keep on catching them constantly and systematically and exiling them abroad. I beg you to show this secretly and without making any copies of it to members of the Politburo." The extreme secrecy was natural in view of the importance and instructive impact of the measure. The crystal-clear lineup of forces on the class front in Soviet Russia was, to put it simply, spoiled by the presence of this shapeless, jelly-like stain of the old bourgeois intelligentsia, which, in the ideological area, genuinely played the role of military spies, and the very best solution one could imagine was to scrape off that stagnant scum of ideas and toss it out abroad. Comrade Lenin had already been stricken by his illness, but the members of the Politburo had apparently given their approval, and Comrade Dzerzhinsky had done the catching. At the end of 1922, about 300 prominent Russian humanists were loaded onto a barge, perhaps? No, they were put on a steamer and sent off to the European garbage dump. Among those who settled down in exile and acquired reputations were the philosophers N. O. Losky, S. N. Bulgakov, N. A. Berdyaev, F. A. Stepun, B. P. Vyacheslavstev, L. P. Karsavin, S. L. Frank, I. A. Ilin. The historians S. P. Melgunov, V. A. Mayakutin, A. A. Kidzeveta, I. I. Lapshin, and others. The writers and publicists Y. I. Eichenfeld, A. S. Idzgoyev, M. A. Osorgin, A. V. Peshekonov. At the beginning of 1923, additional small groups were sent off, including, for example, V. F. Bulgakov, the secretary of Lev Tolstoy. And because of questionable associations, some mathematicians also shared this fate, including D. F. Silivanov. However, it didn't work out constantly and systematically. Perhaps the roar with which the émigrés announced that they regarded it as a gift made it apparent that this punishment left something to be desired, that it was a mistake to have let go good material for the executioner, and that poisonous flowers might grow on that garbage dump. And so they abandoned this form of punishment, and all subsequent purging led to either the executioner or the archipelago. The improved criminal code, promulgated in 1926, which in effect continued right into Khrushchev's times, tied all the formerly scattered political articles into one durable dragnet, Article 58, and the roundup was underway. The catch swiftly expanded to include the engineering and technical intelligentsia. It was especially dangerous because it occupied a firm position in the economy, and it was hard to keep an eye on it with the help of the progressive doctrine alone. It now became clear that the trial in defense of Oldenburger had been a mistake. After all, a very nice little center had been organized there. And Krylenko's declaration that there was no question of sabotage on the part of the engineers in 1920 and 1921 had granted an all-too-hasty absolution. Now it was not sabotage, but worse, wrecking, a word discovered, it appears, by a rank-and-file interrogator in the Schachty case. It had no sooner been established that wrecking was what had to be tracked down, notwithstanding the non-existence of this concept in the entire history of mankind, than they began to discover it without any trouble, in all branches of industry and in all individual enterprises. However, there was no unity of plan, no perfection of execution in all these hit-or-miss discoveries, although Stalin, by virtue of his character, and of course the entire investigative branch of our judicial apparatus, evidently aspired to just that. But our law had finally matured and could show the world something really perfect, a big, coordinated, well-organized trial, this time a trial of engineers. And that is how the Schachty case came about. K. The Schachty Case, May the 18th to July the 15th, 1928. This case was tried before a special assize of the Supreme Court of the USSR under presiding Judge A.Y. Vyshinsky, who was still the rector of First Moscow University. The chief accuser was N.V. Krylenko. What a significant encounter, rather like a handing over of the juridical relay baton. And the members of the tribunal were the old revolutionaries Vasil Yevyuzhin and Antonov Saratovsky. The very simple folk sound of their family names inclines one to a favorable reaction. They are easy to remember, and when suddenly in 1962 obituaries of certain victims of repression appeared in his vestia, whose signature was at the bottom? That of the long-lived Antonov Saratovsky. There were 53 defendants and 56 witnesses. How spectacular! Alas, in its spectacular aspect lay the weakness of this case. If one were to tie to each of the defendants only 3 threads of evidence, there would still have to be 159 of them. And meanwhile, Krylenko had only 10 fingers and Vyshinsky another 10. Of course, the defendants strove to expose their heinous crimes to society, but not all of them did. Only 16. 13 wiggled back and forth, and 24 didn't admit their guilt at all. This introduced an impermissible discord, and the masses could certainly not understand it. Along with its positive aspects, which had incidentally already been displayed in earlier trials, such as the helplessness of the defendants and of the defense attorneys, and their inability either to budge or to deflect the implacable boulder of the sentence, the shortcomings of the new trial were fully apparent. Someone less experienced than Krylenko might have forgiven them, but not he. On the threshold of the classless society, we were at last capable of realizing the conflictless trial, a reflection of the absence of inner conflict in our social structure, in which not only the judge and the prosecutor, but also the defense lawyers and the defendants themselves, would strive collectively to achieve their common purpose. Anyway, the whole scale of the Schachty case, comprising as it did the coal industry alone and the Donetsk Basin alone, was disproportionately paltry for this era. It appears that then and there, on the day the Schachty case ended, Krylenko began to dig a new, capacious pit. Even two of his own colleagues in the Schachty case, the public accusers Osadichi and Schein, fell into it. And it goes without saying that the entire apparatus of the OGPU, which had already landed in Yagoda's firm hands, aided him willingly and adroitly. It was necessary to create and uncover an engineer's organization which encompassed the entire country, and for this purpose it was essential to have several strong, prominent wreckers at its head. And what engineer was unaware of just such an unequivocally strong and impatiently proud leader, Pyotr Akimovich Palchinsky? An important mining engineer from as far back as the beginning of the century, He had been the deputy chairman of the War Industry Committee during World War I. In other words, he had directed the war efforts of all Russian industry, which had managed, during the course of the war, to make up for the failures in Tsarist preparations. After February 1917, he became the deputy minister of trade and industry. He had been persecuted under the Tsar for revolutionary activity. He had been imprisoned 3 times after October, in 1917, 1918, and 1922. From 1920 on, he had been a professor at the Mining Institute and a consultant to the Gosplan, the State Planning Commission. For more details about him, see Part 3, Chapter 10. They picked this Palchinsky to be the chief defendant in a grandiose new trial. However, the thoughtless Krylenko, stepping into what was for him a new field, engineering, not only knew nothing about the resistance of materials, but could not even conceive of the potential resistance of souls, despite 10 years of already sensational activity as a prosecutor. Krylenko's choice turned out to be a mistake. Palchinsky resisted every pressure the Ogpu knew, and did not surrender. In fact, he died without signing any sort of nonsense at all. N.K. von Meck and A.F. Belichko were subjected to torture with him, and they, too, appear not to have given in. We do not yet know whether they died while under torture or whether they were shot, but they proved it was possible to resist and that it was possible not to give in, and thus they left behind a spotlight of reproach to shine on all the famous subsequent defendants. To cover up his defeat, on May the 24th, 1929, Yagoda published a brief GPU communique on the execution of the 3 for large-scale wrecking, which also announced the condemnation of many other unidentified persons. But how much time had been spent for nothing, nearly a whole year, and how many nights of interrogation, and how much inventiveness on the part of the interrogators, and all to no avail. And Krylenko had to start over from the very beginning and find a leader who was both brilliant and strong, and at the same time utterly weak and totally pliable. But so little did he understand this cursed breed of engineers that another whole year was spent in unsuccessful tries. From the summer of 1929 on, he worked over Krennikov, but Krennikov, too, died without agreeing to play a dastardly role. They twisted old Fedotov, but he was too old, and furthermore he was a textile engineer, which was an unprofitable field. And one more year was wasted. The country was waiting for the all-inclusive wreckers' trial, and Comrade Stalin was waiting. But things just couldn't seem to fall into place for Krylenko. And it is quite possible that this failure of his was held against him by the leader and led to the symbolic destruction of the prosecutor on the very same guillotine as his victims. It was only in the summer of 1930 that someone found or suggested Ramzin, the director of the Thermal Engineering Institute. He was arrested, and in 3 months a magnificent drama was prepared and performed, the genuine perfection of our justice and an unattainable model for world justice. L. The Prompati, Industrial Party, Trial. November the 25th to December the 7th, 1930. This case was tried at a special assize of the Supreme Court with the same Vyshinsky, the same Antonov Saratovsky, and that same favorite of ours, Krylenko. This time, none of those technical reasons arose to prevent the readers being offered a full stenographic report of the trial, or to prohibit the attendance of foreign correspondents. There was a majesty of concept. All the nation's industry, all its branches and planning organs, sat on the defendant's benches. However, only the eyes of the man who arranged it all could see the crevices into which the mining industry and railroad transportation had disappeared. At the same time, there was a thrift in the use of material. There were only 8 defendants in all. The mistakes of the Shakhty trial had been taken into account. You are going to exclaim, can 8 men represent the entire industry of the country? Yes, indeed, we have more even than we need. 3 out of 8 are solely in textiles, representing the industrial branch most important for national defense. But there were, no doubt, crowds of witnesses, just 7 in all, who were exactly the same sort of wreckers as the defendants, and were also prisoners. But there were no doubt bales of documents that exposed them. Drawings, projects, directives, summaries of results, proposals, dispatches, private correspondence. No, not one. You mean to say not even one tiny piece of paper? How could the GPU let that sort of thing get by? They had arrested all those people and they hadn't even grabbed one little piece of paper. There had been a lot, but it had all been destroyed, because there was no place to keep the files. At the trial, they produced only a few newspaper articles published in the émigré press and our own. But in that event, how could the prosecution present its case? Well, to be sure, there was Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko, and to be sure, it wasn't the first time either. The best evidence, no matter what the circumstances, is the confessions of the defendants. But what confessions? These confessions were not forced, but inspired. Repentance tearing whole monologues from the breast, and talk, talk, and more talk, and self-exposure and self-flagellation. They told old man Fedotov, who was 66, that he could sit down, that he had talked long enough. But no, he kept pouring out additional explanations and interpretations. For 5 sessions in a row, no questions were asked. The defendants kept talking and talking and explaining, and kept asking for the floor again in order to supply whatever they had left out. They presented inferentially everything the prosecution needed without any questions whatever being asked. Ramzin, after extensive explanations, went on to provide brief resumes for the sake of clarity, as if he were addressing slow-witted students. The defendants were afraid, most of all, that something might be left unexplained, that someone might go unexposed, that someone's name might go unmentioned, that someone's intention to wreck might not have been made clear. And how they reviled themselves. I am a class enemy. I was bribed. Our bourgeois ideology. And then the prosecutor. Was that your error? And Chernovsky replied. And crime. There was simply nothing for Krylenko to do. For 5 sessions he went on drinking tea and eating cookies, or whatever else they brought him. But how did the defendant sustain such an emotional explosion? There was no tape recorder to take down their words, but Otsep, the defense attorney, described them. The defendant's words flowed in a businesslike manner, cold and professionally calm. There you are, such a passion for confession, and businesslike at the same time. Cold? More than that, they appear to have mumbled their glib repentance so listlessly that Bashinsky often asked them to speak louder, more clearly, because they couldn't be heard. The harmony of the trial was not at all disturbed by the defense, which agreed with all the prosecutor's proposals. The principal defense lawyer called the prosecutor's summation historic and described his own as narrow, admitting that in making it he had gone against the dictates of his heart, for a Soviet defense lawyer is first of all a Soviet citizen, and, like all workers, he too is outraged at the crimes of the defendants. During the trial, the defense asked shy and tentative questions and then instantly backed away from them if Fischinski interrupted. The lawyers actually defended only 2 harmless textile officials and did not challenge the formal charges nor the description of the defendant's actions, but asked only whether the defendants might avoid execution. Is it more useful, comrade judges, to have their corpses or their labor? How foul-smelling were the crimes of these bourgeois engineers. Here is what they consisted of. They planned to reduce the tempo of development, as, for instance, to an overall annual increase in production of only 20 to 22%, whereas the workers were prepared to increase it by 40 to 50%. They slowed down the rate of mining local fuels. They were too slow in developing the Kuznetsk Basin. They exploited theoretical and economic arguments, such as whether to supply the Donetsk Basin with electricity from the Dnieper power station, or whether to build a super-trunk line between Moscow and the Donbass, in order to delay the solutions of important problems. The work stops while engineers argue. They postponed considering new engineering projects, that is, they did not authorize them immediately. In lectures on the resistance of materials, they took an anti-Soviet line. They installed worn-out equipment. They tied up capital funds, for example, by using them for costly and lengthy construction projects. They carried out unnecessary repairs. They misused metals. Some grades of iron were wanting. They created an imbalance between the departments of a plant and between the supply of raw materials and the capacity for processing them industrially. This was particularly notable in the textile industry, where they built one or two factories more than they needed to process the cotton harvest. Then they leapt from minimal to maximal plans, and obvious wrecking began through the accelerated development of that same unfortunate textile industry. Most importantly, they planned sabotage in the field of electric power, even though none was ever carried out. Thus, wrecking did not take the form of actual damage done, but remained within the area of operational planning. Yet it was intended to lead to a nationwide crisis, and even to economic paralysis in 1930. But it didn't, and only because of the competitive industrial and financial plans of the masses, doubling the figures. Yeah, begins the skeptical reader. What? That isn't enough for you? But if, at the trial, we repeat every point and chew it over 5 or 8 times, then perhaps it turns out not to be so negligible. Yeah. The reader of the 60s nonetheless sticks to his own view. Mightn't all that have happened precisely because of those competing industrial and financial plans? Aren't things bound to be out of balance if any union meeting, without consulting Gosplan, can twist the ratios around as it pleases? Oh, the prosecutor's bread is bitter. After all, they decided to publish every last word. That meant that engineers would read it too. You've made your bed, now lie on it. And Krylenko rushed in fearlessly to discuss and to question and cross-question engineering details. And the inside pages and inserts of the enormous newspapers were full of small print about fine technical points. The notion was that every reader would be overcome by the sheer mass of material, that he wouldn't have enough time, even if he used up all his evenings and his rest days, too. And so he wouldn't read it all, but would only notice the refrain following every few paragraphs. We were wreckers, wreckers, wreckers. But suppose someone did begin and read every last line. In that case, he would come to see, through the banality of self-accusations, composed with such ineptitude and stupidity, that the Lubyanka boa constrictor had gotten involved in something outside its competence, its own kind of work. That what breaks free of the crude noose is the strong-winged thought of the 20th century. There the prisoners are, in the dock, submissive, repressed. But their thought leaps out. Even their terrified, tired tongues manage to name everything with its proper name and to tell us everything. Here is the situation in which they worked. Kalinnikov. Well, to be sure, a situation of technical distrust was created. Larichev. Whether we wanted to or not, we still had to produce that 42 millions of tons of petroleum. That is, it had been thus ordered from on high. Because no matter what, 42 million tons of petroleum could not have been produced under any circumstances whatever. All the work of that unhappy generation of our engineers was squeezed between two such impossibilities. The Thermal Engineering Institute was proud of its principal research achievement, which was the sharply improved coefficient of fuel consumption. On this basis, lower requirements for fuel production had been stipulated in the preliminary plan. And that meant wrecking, reducing fuel resources. In the transportation plan, they had provided for all freight cars to be equipped with automatic coupling. And that meant wrecking. They had tied up capital funds. After all, it takes a long time to introduce automatic coupling, and the capital investment involved in installing it can only be recouped over a long period, and we want everything immediately. In order to make more efficient use of single-track railroads, they decided to increase the size of the locomotives and freight cars. And was that considered modernization? No, it was wrecking. Because in that case it would have been necessary to invest funds in strengthening the roadbeds and the superstructures of the bridges. From the profound economic consideration that in America capital is cheap and labor dear, and that the situation here is just the opposite, and that we therefore ought not to borrow things with monkey-like imitativeness, Fedotov concluded that it was useless for us to purchase expensive American assembly line machinery. For the next 10 years, it would be more profitable for us to buy less sophisticated English machinery and to put more workers on it, since it was inevitable that in 10 years' time whatever we had purchased would be replaced anyway, no matter what. And we could then buy more expensive machinery. So that, too, was wrecking. Alleging economy as his reason, what he really wanted, they charged, was to avoid having the most advanced type of machinery in Soviet industry. They began to build new factories out of reinforced concrete, instead of cheaper, ordinary concrete, on the grounds that over a 100-year period, reinforced concrete would recoup the additional investment many times over. So that, too, was wrecking, tying up capital, using up scarce reinforcing rods when iron was in short supply. What was it supposed to be kept for? False teeth? From among the dependents, Fedotov willingly conceded, "Of course, if every kopeck must be counted today, then it could be considered wrecking. The English say, I'm not rich enough to buy cheap goods." He tries softly to explain to the hard-headed prosecutor, "Theoretical approaches of every kind of project norms, which in the final analysis are, they will be considered to be, wrecking." "Well, tell me now, how much more clearly could a frightened dependent speak out? What is theory to us is wrecking to you, because you are compelled to grab today without any thought for tomorrow." Old Fedotov tries to explain where thousands and millions of rubles are lost in the insane rush of the 5-year plan. Cotton is not sorted where it is grown, so that every factory can be sent that grade and kind of cotton it requires. Instead, it is shipped any old way, all mixed up. But the prosecutor doesn't listen to him. With the stubbornness of a block of stone, he keeps coming back again and again, 10 times, to the more obvious question he has put together out of children's building blocks. Why did they begin to build the so-called factory palaces with high ceilings, broad corridors, and unnecessarily good ventilation? Was that not the most obvious sort of wrecking? After all, that amounted to tying up capital irrevocably. The bourgeois wreckers explained to him that the People's Commissariat of Labour wanted to build factories for the workers in the land of the proletariat, which were spacious and had good air. That means there are also wreckers in the People's Commissariat of Labour. Make a note of that. The doctors had insisted on 30 feet of space between floors, and Fedotov reduced it to 20. So why not to 16? Now that was wrecking. If he had reduced it to 15, that would have been flagrant wrecking. He would have wanted to create the nightmare conditions of a capitalist factory for free Soviet workers. They explained, Krylenko, that in relation to the entire cost of the factory and its equipment, this difference accounted for 3% of the total. But no, again and again and again, he keeps on about the height of the ceilings. And how did they dare install such powerful ventilators? They took into account the hottest summer days. Why the hottest days? So what? Let the workers sweat a little on the hottest days. And in the meantime, the disproportions were inherent. Bungling organization thought of that before there was any engineer's center, Charnovsky. No wrecking activities were ever necessary. All one had to do was carry out the appropriate actions and everything would happen on its own. Charnovsky again. He could not have expressed himself more clearly, and he said this after many months in the Lubyanka and from the defendant's bench in court. The appropriate actions, that is, those imposed by bungling higher-ups, were quite enough. Carry them out and the unthinkable plan would destroy itself. Here was their kind of wrecking. We had the capability of producing, say, 1,000 tons, and we were ordered, in other words, by a nonsensical plan, to produce 3,000, so we took no steps to produce them. You must admit that for an official, double-checked, spruced-up stenographic record in those years, this is not so little. On many occasions, Krylenko drives his actors to tones of exhaustion, thanks to the nonsense they are compelled to grind out over and over again. like a bad play in which the actor is ashamed for the dramatist, and yet has to go on and on anyway to keep body and soul together. Krylenko, do you agree?
Fedotov,
I agree, even though in general I do not think... Krylenko, do you confirm this?
Fedotov,
properly speaking, in certain portions, and so to speak in general, yes. For the engineers, those who were still free, not yet imprisoned, and who had to face the necessity of working cheerfully after the defamation of the trial of their whole class, there was no way out. They were damned if they did, and damned if they didn't. If they went forward, it was wrong. And if they went backward, it was wrong, too. If they hurried, they were hurrying for the purpose of wrecking. If they moved methodically, it meant wrecking by slowing down tempos. If they were painstaking in developing some branch of industry, it was intentional delay, sabotage. And if they indulged in capricious leaps, their intention was to produce an imbalance for the purpose of wrecking. Using capital for repairs, improvements, or capital readiness was tying up capital funds. And if they allowed equipment to be used until it broke down, it was a diversionary action. In addition, the interrogators would get all this information out of them by subjecting them to sleeplessness and punishment cells, and then demanding that they give convincing examples of how they might have carried on wrecking activities. Give us a clear example. Give us a clear example of your wrecking activity. The impatient Krylenko urges them on. They will give you outstanding examples. Just wait. Soon someone will write the history of the technology of those years. He will give you examples and negative examples. He will evaluate for you all the convulsions of your epileptic 5-year plan in 4 years. Then we will find out how much of the people's wealth and strength was squandered. Then we will find out how all the best projects were destroyed and how the worst projects were carried out by the worst means. Well, yes. If the Mao Tse-tung breed of Red Guard youths supervise brilliant engineers, what good can come of it? Dilettante enthusiasts, they were the ones who egged on their even stupider leaders. Yes, full details are a disservice. Somehow the more details provided, the less the evil deed seemed to smell of execution. But just a moment. We've not had everything yet. The most important crimes all lie ahead. Here they are. Here they come. Comprehensible and intelligible to every illiterate. The Prompt Party, 1, prepared the way for the intervention, 2, took money from the imperialists, 3, conducted espionage, 4, assigned cabinet posts in a future government. And that did it. All mouths were shut, and all those who had been expressing their reservations fell silent, and only the tramping of demonstrators could be heard, and the roars outside the window. Death! 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 What about some more details? Why should you want more details? Well, then, if that's the way you want it. But they will only be more frightening. They were all acting under orders from the French General's staff. After all, France doesn't have enough worries or difficulties or party conflicts of its own, and it is enough just to whistle, and lo and behold, divisions will march. Intervention. First they planned it for 1928, but they couldn't come to an agreement. They couldn't tie up all the loose ends. All right, so they postponed it to 1930. But once more, they couldn't agree among themselves. All right, 1931, then. And as a matter of fact, here's how it was to go. France herself would not fight, but as her commission for organizing the deal would take the Ukraine right bank as her share. England wouldn't fight either, of course, but in order to raise a scare, promised to send her fleet into the Black Sea and into the Baltic. In return, she would get Caucasian oil. The actual warriors would, for the most part, be the following. 100,000 émigrés, true they had long since scattered to the four winds, but it would take only a whistle to gather them all together again immediately. Poland, for which she would get half the Ukraine, Romania, whose brilliant successes in World War I were famous. She was a formidable enemy. and then there were Latvia and Estonia. These two small countries would willingly drop all the concerns of their young government and rush forth en masse to do battle. And the most frightening thing of all was the direction of the main blow. How's that? Was it already known? Yes. It would begin from Bessarabia, and from there, keeping to the right bank of the Dnieper, it would move straight on Moscow. Who drew that arrow for Krylenko on a cigarette pack? Was it not drawn by the same hand that thought up our entire defense strategy in 1941? And at that fateful moment, would not all our railroads certainly be blown up? No, not at all. Bottlenecks would be created. And the Brum Party would also yank out the fuses in electric power stations, and the entire Soviet Union would be plunged into darkness, and all our machinery would come to a halt, including the textile machinery. And sabotage would be carried out. Attention, defendants, you must not name your methods of sabotage, nor the factories which were your objectives, nor the geographic sites involved, until the closed session. And you must not name names, whether foreign or our own. Combine all this with the fatal blow which will have been dealt the textile industry by that time. Add the fact that the saboteurs will have constructed two or three textile factories in Byelorussia, which will serve as a base of operations for the interventionists. This was not intended as a joke. With the textile factories already in their hands, the interventionists would march implacably on Moscow. But here was the cleverest part of the whole plot. Though they didn't succeed in doing so, they had wanted to drain the Kuban marshes and the Polisai swamps and the swamp near Lake Ilmen. Vyshinsky had forbidden them to name the exact places, but one of the witnesses blurted them out. And then the interventionists would open up the shortest routes and would get to Moscow without wetting their feet or their horses' hoofs. And why was it so hard for the Tatars? Why was it that Napoleon didn't reach Moscow? Yes, it was because of the Polisai and the Ilmen swamps. And once those swamps were drained, the capital would lie exposed. On top of that, don't forget to add that hangars had been built there under the guise of sawmills, places not to be named, so that the planes of the interventionists would not get wet in the rain and could be taxied into them. And housing for the interventionists had also been built. Do not name the places. And where had all the homeless occupation armies been quartered in previous wars? The defendants had received all the directives on these matters from the mysterious foreign gentlemen, K and R. It is strictly forbidden to name their names or to name the countries they come from. And most recently they had even begun the preparation of treasonable actions by individual units of the Red Army. Do not name the branches of the service, nor the units, nor the names of any persons involved. True, they hadn't done any of this, but they had also intended, though they hadn't done that either, to organize within some central army institution a cell of financiers and former officers of the White Armies. Ah, the White Army, write it down, start making arrests. And cells of anti-Soviet students. Students, write it down, start making arrests. Incidentally, don't push things too far. We wouldn't want the workers to get despondent and begin to feel that everything is falling apart, that the Soviet government has been caught napping. And so they also threw a good deal of light on that side of it, that they had intended to do a lot and had accomplished very little, that not one industry had suffered serious losses. But why didn't the intervention take place anyway? For various complex reasons. Either because Poincaré hadn't been elected in France, or else because our émigré industrialists decided that their former enterprises had not yet been sufficiently restored by the Bolsheviks. Let the Bolsheviks do more. And then, too, they couldn't seem to come to terms with Poland and Romania. So, all right, there hadn't been any intervention, but there was at least a Prom Party. Do you hear the tramp of marching feet? Do you hear the murmur of the working masses? Death! 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 And the marchers were those who in the event of war would have to atone with their deaths and deprivations and sufferings for the work of these men. and it was as if he had looked into a crystal ball. It was indeed with their deaths and deprivations and sufferings that those trusting demonstrators would atone in 1941 for the work of these men. But where is your finger pointing, prosecutor? At whom is your finger pointing? So then, why was it the Industrial Party? Why a party and not an engineering technical centre? We are accustomed to having a centre. Yes, there was a centre too, but they had decided to reorganise themselves into a party. It was more respectable. That way it would be easier to fight over cabinet posts in the future government. It would mobilise the engineering technical masses for the struggle for power. And whom would they be struggling against? Other parties, of course, against the Working Peasants' Party, the TKP, in the first place, for after all they had 200,000 members, against the Menshevik Party in the second place. And as for a centre, those three parties together were to have constituted a united centre, but the GPU had destroyed them. And it's a good thing they destroyed us! All the defendants were glad. And it was flattering to Stalin to annihilate three more parties. Would there have been any glory indeed in merely adding another three centres to his list? And having a party instead of a centre meant having another central committee. Yes, the Prom Party's own central committee. True, there had not been any party conferences, nor had there been any elections, not even one. Whoever wanted to be on the central committee just joined up. Five people, all told. They all made way for one another, and they all yielded the post of chairman to one another, too. There were no meetings, either of the Central Committee. No one else would remember this, but Ramzin would remember it very well indeed, and he would name names. Or of the groups from various branches of industry. There seemed even to be some dearth of members. As Charnovsky said, there never was any formal organization of a prom party. And how many members had there been? Larichev. A count of members would have been difficult. The exact composition was unknown. And how had they carried out their wrecking? How had directives been communicated? Well, it was just a matter of whoever met whomever in some particular institution. Directives were passed on orally. From then on, everyone would carry out his own wrecking on his own conscience. Well, now, Ramzin confidently named 2,000 members. And whenever he named two, they arrested five. According to the documents in the trial, there were altogether 30,000 to 40,000 engineers throughout the USSR. That meant they would arrest every seventh one and terrify the other six. And what about contacts with the Working Peasants' Party? Well, they might meet in the State Planning Commission or else in the Supreme Council of the Economy and plan systematic acts against village communists. Where have we seen all this before? Aha! In Aida. They are seeing Radames off on his campaign, and the orchestra is thundering, and eight warriors are standing there in helmets and with spears, and 2,000 more are painted on the backdrop. That's your prom party. But that's all right. It works. The show goes on. Today it is quite impossible to believe just how threatening and serious it all looked at the time. And it is hammered in by repetition, and every individual episode is gone over several times, and because of this the awful visions multiply. And in addition, so that things won't become too bland, the defendants suddenly forget something terribly unimportant, or else they try to renounce testimony, and right then and there they pin them down with cross-questioning. And it all winds up being as lively as the Moscow Art Theatre. But Krylenko pressed too hard. On the one hand, he planned to disembowel the prom party, to disclose its social basis. That was a question of class, and his analysis couldn't go wrong. But Krylenko abandoned the Stanislavski method, didn't assign the roles, relied on improvisation. He let everyone tell his own story of his own life and what his relationship to the revolution had been and how he was led to participate in wrecking. And in one fell swoop, that thoughtless insertion, that human picture, spoiled all five acts. The first thing that we learn, to our astonishment, is that all eight of these big shots of the bourgeois intelligentsia came from poor families. The son of a peasant, one of the many children of a clerk, the son of an artisan, the son of a rural schoolteacher, the son of a peddler. At school they were all impoverished and earned the money for their education themselves, from the ages of 12, 13, and 14. Some gave lessons, and some worked on locomotives. And here was what was monstrous. No one barred their way to an education. They all completed the courses in high school and in higher technological institutions, and they became important and famous professors. How could that have been? They always told us that under Tsarism only the children of landowners and capitalists. Those calendars certainly couldn't have been lying. And here and now, in the Soviet period, engineers were in a very difficult position. It was almost impossible for them to provide their children with a higher education. After all, the children of the intelligentsia had the lowest priority, remember? The court didn't argue, nor did Krylenko. And the defendants themselves hastened to qualify what they had said, asserting that, against